Live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania, it's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, "We are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better." It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnson.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, and the rest of humanity living on the planet Earth who are listening via live streaming. This is Chris Arnson, your host of Iron Sharpens Iron, wishing you all a happy Wednesday on this sixth day of April 2016. And today we are going to be discussing something that is going to be frustrating to many of you, enraging, maddening, saddening, but God is still on the throne and still in control over all the universe. We're going to be talking today about the utter madness of the leftist homosexual totalitarian agenda. And our guests today to discuss this are first, for the first hour, Andrew Beckwith, who is the president of the Massachusetts Family Institute. Andrew has been on our broadcast once before. In our second hour, we are going to be interviewing an anonymous woman who Andrew has worked with, Diane X, we are calling her. And Diane is the mother of a boy who was identified by his school counselor as being gay and who was later removed from his Christian home by the Department of Children and Families, otherwise known as DCF. And we're going to be talking about this horrific, nightmarish scenario that is sounds like the script from a really bad movie. But first of all, welcome back to Iron Sharpens Iron, Andrew Beckwith.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
And for our listeners who are discovering you for the first time, who didn't hear you on our last program, why don't you tell our listeners something about the Massachusetts Family Institute?
Sure. Massachusetts Family Institute, or MFI as we call it, is the local associate in Massachusetts for focus on the family. We're part of a 38-state network of family policy councils that are associated with focus on the family, also the Family Research Council with Tony Perkins in Washington, D.C., as well as Alliance Defending Freedom, the Christian Legal Center out of Scottsdale, Arizona. So we are sort of a network of pro-family organizations that are part of Dr. James Dobson's vision of having public policy boots on the ground in individual states to continue the work that he started there at Focus.
Yeah, we just had Kerry Kupek of Alliance Defending Freedom on the program just about a week or two ago.
Wonderful.
And I'm no stranger to them, as they represented my dear friend Dr. James R. White of Alpha and Omega Ministries when he debated Barry Lynn, the president of the Americans United for Separation of Church and State organization. At least he was the president back then. And Dr. Lynn was defending homosexuality as being completely compatible with biblical Christianity. And Dr. White thoroughly but kindly and like a gentleman destroyed him in that debate. When I say destroyed, I mean, and I had to preface it by saying he was kind and a gentleman because he was not mean-spirited or did not use mockery or anything like that. But Mr. Lynn, or Dr. Lynn, or Reverend Lynn, because he's an ordained United Church of Christ minister, showed up at this debate even though he knew it was on biblical data. He didn't even have a Bible with him and had a yellow legal pad, and I just think he thought he was going to steamroller through that debate knowing that he was an ACLU attorney at one point, and he just lost miserably and threatened to sue Alpha and Omega Ministries if they distributed the video of the the debate. But thankfully, Mr. Lynn and his attorneys and everyone at the organization he represents failed to make it to the hearing. So the judge saw in favor of Alpha and Omega Ministries, and they were able to continue distributing the video. But
that sort of proves the rule that the first thing you have to do if you want to win is to show up to the fight. And so that's what we're trying to encourage people to do here in Massachusetts in the public policy arena.
And I'd like to introduce you to my co-host, who's been a co-host with me for the last several months, I believe, Reverend Buzz Taylor.
Hello.
Good afternoon, Reverend.
Good to meet you.
And how long has it been?
Well, it's been 2 months, actually.
2 months? Okay, I guess it just seems like an eternity.
Yes, I'm.
And Reverend Buzz pointed out to me recently that I have to change our opening announcement because we went from 1 hour to 2 hours quite a long time ago, and the announcement still says 1 hour. So, but anyway, well, why don't you keep us up to speed before we give a little bit of a precursor to our second hour with Diane X. Why don't you give us some scenarios of things that the Massachusetts Family Institute has been battling there in your state recently?
Sure. Well, there's sort of, as I like to tell people, there's three things you're not supposed to talk about in polite company, sex, religion, and politics, and my job is to tackle all three at once. and so the public policy initiatives, the legislation that we've been fighting here in Massachusetts, focus on issues of life, whether it's abortion or suicide, issues surrounding human sexuality, homosexuality and transgenderism, and also religious liberty issues. So, for example, there is an assisted suicide measure that's in the legislature here. There was a statewide referendum on that issue in 2012, and it was narrowly defeated, so we were able to stave off sort of Dr. Kevorkian, you know, physician-assisted suicide bills in 2012, and we're still doing that now. And on the other end of the life spectrum, we have a very strong pro-family legislator, Representative Jim Lyons from Andover, Massachusetts, who is fighting to defund Planned Parenthood based on the videos from last summer, the allegations there. In addition, Planned Parenthood's got its fingers in a lot of things. The Planned Parenthood League of Massachusetts has put together a Get Real curriculum. That's their title for it. It's a comprehensive sex ed curriculum for middle schoolers. Now, I've got a son in middle school. We homeschool, but that's the age he is, and I ordered the curriculum to see what exactly it is they're trying to promote. And when I spoke about it on the radio here previously, I had to talk with the host in advance and coordinate certain euphemisms. So I don't want to... he was afraid of losing his FCC license. I won't get into the details, but suffice it to say, before this job, I was a prosecutor in the Marine Corps and had my share of unsavory sexual assault crimes that I prosecuted. And I learned things and learned about certain acts in this middle school curriculum from Planned Parenthood that I had not encountered in the Marines. I kind of speak for itself there. Now, one bill in particular that I think we spoke about last time, it sort of plays into what Diane, your guest next there, I'll be talking about, is it's House Bill 97, but it's entitled An Act Relative to Abusive Practices to Change Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity in Minors. We call it the Sexual Orientation Counseling Ban. Communicates better what it's about. And this essentially would say, if you have a child, middle school perhaps, so under 18, who is struggling with sexual orientation issues or gender identity confusion, and you take them to a licensed mental health professional to, you know, find ways to live out, you know, a Christian sexual ethic. So either to, you know, get married to an opposite sex partner eventually and have children, Lord willing, despite having some same-sex attraction, or if it's a gender identity confusion, let's say it's a young girl who thinks maybe she's actually a boy on the inside because that's what the counselor at school is telling her, this would be treatment, talk therapy, just to help her feel comfortable in her own skin as opposed to being injected with puberty blockers, testosterone, and having healthy reproductive organs removed surgically. So that's the type of treatment that this bill would we see now that we've gone from, in the sexual revolution, which, you know, there's the landmark same-sex marriage case before Obergefell at the National Supreme Court. You had the decision right here in Massachusetts in 2003, legalizing same-sex marriage. But we've gone from, you know, allowing people to do what they want to do sexually in the privacy of their own bedrooms to now that same activity is being forced upon us in our classrooms, and even in our homes, in the counselor's office, is now the target of this agenda.
Yeah, this is real frightening stuff. This is not only frightening, but it's sick, it's twisted. When you think about government agencies intruding into the private lives of families and forcing by legal mandate the celebration of this evil behavior, that we who are Christians and also those who are Orthodox Jews and members of other religions that share our biblical morality, that, you know, this behavior that we view as unnatural and damning, and it's just absolutely breathtakingly disturbing that these things are happening. You know, I can't help but think of a very famous novel, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, and you maybe think this is weird to bring this up, but that was an adult who lived in this fantasy world about being all kinds of heroic figures and so on, and children live in fantasy worlds. They don't really know what their goals are in life yet, or what they're going to be. They're very often confused about a lot of things, and live in a world of imagination a lot of times, and sometimes it's to an unhealthy degree, obviously. But to think that children are mature enough and responsible enough and accountable enough to make decisions regarding their sexuality and their actual gender,
right.
Obviously we would say that they can never change their gender, no matter what kind of medication or surgery may be performed on them. But to think that parents and physicians would be a party to this mutilation or even considering it, it's utterly amazing.
It is. It's very tragic. And we have, in addition to this legislation, probably one that's getting more attention on a national level at this point, is we refer to it as the bathroom bill. Essentially, it prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender identity in public accommodations. However, that basically is already covered by existing law in Massachusetts, with the exception of bathrooms, restrooms, and locker rooms, places that are, you know, typically single-sex facilities, where the sexes are lawfully segregated for obvious, what we think would be obvious reasons. So the LGBT community is really pushing that bill here in Massachusetts, referred to as the bathroom bill, and it was both sort of sad and bewildering at the public hearing on that bill back in October, where you had one mom came with a picture of her son, who identifies as female. So he was sort of dressed up to look like a young girl in this sort of like a big school picture she had blown up. And she testified how things sort of coalesced or crystallized for them and for her son, who again she referred to as daughter, when they went to Disney World and her son met Mulan, an actor playing Mulan, one of the Disney characters, and started singing Mulan's theme song to Mulan, and somehow that crystallized that this young boy is actually a girl. I haven't actually seen the Mulan movie, but it's I think a young Chinese princess maybe dresses up like a boy and sort of participates with some of the samurai or whatever. But basically that was the basis upon which this family decided, okay, this our son is really our daughter.
Wow.
A Disney theme song for a Disney cartoon movie.
Now, well, you would think that some parents might think that their child is a puppy dog or a frog or a bird, because children imitate those things all the time.
Right. Well, that's sort of trans speciesism, which I just read an article this morning where someone's high school classmate believes she's a wolf and wants to be referred to as a wolf and treated as a wolf.
I said that as a joke, and you're telling me that real
it's out there, and you have
and you think you've heard it all. Yeah.
Transableism, where people who have perfectly healthy bodies want to sort of identify with the disability community and so will sit in a wheelchair even though their legs work perfectly fine and even wear leg braces.
Oh, I've heard about that, where a woman was blinded voluntarily, and a doctor actually participated in that.
Wow.
There is a certain dysphoria where people believe that their limbs are foreign objects and they won't be happy and won't have peace of mind until the limbs are removed. All kinds of obviously sick and twisted things here.
And yet, it's sort of the talk therapy. If you took that, you know, if you take a young woman who has a healthy, physically healthy body, but a troubled mind, and you give her talk therapy to help her feel comfortable in her own skin in California, New Jersey, Oregon, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., that would be illegal. That would be, you know, lose your license as a mental health professional if you did that. You counsel them to sort of be comfortable in their own skin. But if you give them hormone injections and amputate healthy organs, that's fine. So it's sort of a twofold thing. We're normalizing as a culture, as a society, and legally, we're normalizing this idea of transgenderism, mm-hmm. which is still very new and, you know, sort of beyond most people's comprehension or familiarity, but it's being normalized at a very rapid pace, to the extent that you have North Carolina passed, I think last week or possibly a week and a half ago, a bill in response to the city of Charlotte, which created their own bathroom bill, and so the state said, okay, no, we're not doing bathroom bills, we're going to create a statewide law that says if you are a biological male, use the men's room, if you're a biological female, use the women's room. So that's a statewide law now. And they have come under tremendous pressure, not just from the typical, you know, left-wing advocacy groups, but from big business interests, saying that they'll pull out of North Carolina, they'll stop doing business there. Major, you know, Fortune 500 companies. This is sort of the newest front in the culture wars, that you have major corporations now taking sides with a radical left-wing agenda. I mean, all North Carolina's legislature and governor did essentially was say we're going to maintain the status quo. In fact, the Charlotte ordinance hadn't even gone into effect yet. So literally, they passed a law that said we're not going to change the law in this area. So nothing had changed, and yet you have all these major corporations saying they're going to threaten to, you know, leave the state. Even have the Boston City Council saying we're banning all travel to North Carolina. Not that there's been much, you know, city taxpayer-funded travel to North Carolina, I would hope, other than some kind of boondoggles. But you have this massive reaction against laws that say only men's in the men's room and only women in the women's room, which would have been unthinkable even a year or two ago.
You know, I've brought this up before with other guests who have raised this issue about the unisex bathrooms, and there's something that's really puzzling to me, that liberals would be universally in favor of that, because where are these feminists that want to protect women from predatory males who are going to be either leering at them or maybe even trying to attack them in these restrooms? I don't even understand that.
Well, it's even more twisted than that. In fact, you know, I guess the term transgender bathroom is somewhat confusing in the sense that bathrooms themselves will not change. What this law does is it says if you identify as a woman, if a man identifies as a woman, so Bruce Jenner, mm-hmm. calls himself Caitlyn now. I think he's had some makeup and maybe some breast augmentation, but as I understand it, he still is, you know, an intact male.
Still has the same voice of the guy doing the Wheaties commercial that I remember.
Right. But in these laws, you know, under California law, which I think they passed their bathroom bill, Bruce Jenner is a woman, period, for all legal purposes. So it's not that there's now some unisex bathroom that Bruce Jenner gets to use or that has to be built. He just uses the women's room because he is a woman. That's how the law works, that your gender identity is dispositive when it comes to, you know, sex you are. That is what trumps everything else. So if it were a matter of creating a third bathroom, I mean, as onerous as that would be, burdensome to businesses, that would be preferable from a privacy perspective because, okay, at least, you know, everyone's privacy is protected. And that's what they've tried to do in some public schools where you have middle schoolers or high schoolers who have gender identity issues, is to say, well, you're a boy who identifies as a girl, so you're uncomfortable in the boys' room, but the girl's uncomfortable with you because you're anatomically male in the girls' room, so here you can use the nurse's bathroom or the staff bathroom, or we'll make special accommodations. But that has been typically not sufficient, and there have been lawsuits brought by the parents of those kids with gender identity issues to force the schools to let them use the bathroom of their choice. So that boy who believes she's a girl sues and has won in a couple instances, including in Maine, the right to use the girls' room and the girls' locker room. So
ironically, women who have been fighting for all kinds of rights for 100 years or more,
right?
Now they're losing the right of privacy.
Absolutely, no. It's a huge concern. Yeah. Very ironic. Yeah, the women's here in Massachusetts, the Women's Bar Association, coming out in favor of the bathroom bill.
That doesn't make any sense at all.
I mean, just a reflection of this is the current, you know, cause du jour for the left wingers in Massachusetts. So everyone's rallying behind it. Which is sort of the second side of this coin. One, we're normalizing this type of behavior and this type of really a denial of reality, but we're at the same time we're also vilifying any opposition to it. So it's not just, okay, this needs to be something that we all kind of accept. If you don't accept it, if you speak out against it, if you raise any objection on the grounds of privacy or otherwise, you are transphobic, you're bigoted. Or, in my case, when I, at the public hearing, said, well, what do we do about, then my 5-year-old daughter's privacy? And I was told by the chair of the Judiciary Committee hearing the bill, well, you're just going to have to get over it like we got over the objections to desegregation. So basically, you know, we're a bunch of Jim Crow racists because we're not allowing transgender people to use the bathroom they identify with.
And ironically, the racial minorities in this country, even those that are affiliated with theologically liberal churches, it seems that they are breaking the liberal mold and really protesting these things that I mean, obviously you have a number of African-American activists in the spotlight that may be in favor of these things, but it seems that in the inner cities, local pastors from the Black and Hispanic communities especially, even if they're denominational or church affiliation is liberal, they seem to be coming out in droves to protest all kinds of things that involve homosexuality being pushed upon the culture.
Right. I mean, in 2008, in California, that they were sort of what helped get Proposition 8 there over the hump, which for the time codified marriage as a state constitutional amendment between one man and one woman. So there is some separation of the monolithic voting pattern for Democrats in that instance. And really, I think it's offensive. I work with a young African-American man here in the office, and it's personally offensive to him to say that gender identity is the same as race. And of course, that's the narrative that those pushing bills like this use because it gives them sort of instant cultural credibility if they can bootstrap their cause onto the civil rights cause.
Yeah.
But it's really preposterous. We're talking about behavioral choices here, not the color of someone's skin.
Right. Yeah. I hear you saying California and Massachusetts a lot. Are they pretty much the worst states for this kind of stuff?
Typically, yes. I mean, Vermont is kind of a sort of a left wing outlier as well. It's smaller, but we are really the victims, for lack of a better term, of national campaigns and strategies. And so they know folks who are pushing the LGBT issues, who are pushing assisted suicide. They know that the left coast, as it were, and New England, particularly Massachusetts, are on the ground for their endeavors. And if you can get California and Massachusetts, which have a lot of business and financial and academic elites then you know you've got you can really start to work inland.
I remember years ago I lived in Maine, and it was quite popular for a lot of the gay agenda from Massachusetts to come up and try to influence our legislative system.
Yeah, I think Maine's in a much better place now with Governor LePage. And, but talking to my counterparts in Massachusetts, we have one of the most liberal legislatures in the country.
Now, tell us something about the laws that are currently on the books in Massachusetts and include some of the other more liberally governed states, and then give us a broader picture on as much of the United States as you can tell us. But, like, for instance, how young is a child legally able to get involved in, for lack of a better term, borrowing their language, gender reassignment or whatever you want to call it, involving medication and surgery? How young would a parent or parents be legally able to take a child into a hospital or a doctor's office and have these things?
Right. I don't think there's a great question, and the simple answer is I do not know. However, I don't think there's any law. I mean, certainly no law that specifically prohibits gender reassignment surgery at any age.
At any age.
As far as I know, if you have a doctor who is willing to do it, and we have doctors here. Massachusetts, I don't think there's any age threshold that's required. I mean, you have doctors talk about using puberty blockers. So if you take these injections prior to puberty, so now we're talking, 10 or 11 or younger, obviously that the bodies really start to change and diversify during puberty. So you take certain drugs prior to that and take sort of the opposite sex or the target gender's drug hormones, whether it's testosterone or estrogen, and then have surgery to accompany that. And that's talked about regularly in those circles. So we're talking about, 10, 11-year-olds easily. And I know of a case of a woman, she was a young woman at the time, I think 16, maybe 17, when she had her breasts removed and had been taking testosterone since she was 14 or 15. But that was several years ago, and I'm sure they've worked her way younger than that. And you've got even, 3-year-olds who say that they identify as the opposite gender, and the parents and the educators embrace that. So I think hormonal treatments probably start very young. I think I don't know of any actual sex change operations on pre-teenagers. Probably it's just hormonal at that point.
We're going to be going to a break right now. If you'd like to join us on the air with a question of your own for Andrew Beckwith, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Don't go away. We're going to be right back after these messages.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist Church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750, that's 508-528-5750, or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at Providence Baptist Church, ma.org, that's Providence Baptist Church, ma.org, or even on sermonaudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. The New American Standard Bible is perfect for daily reading or in-depth study. Used by pastors, scholars, and everyday readers, the NASB is widely embraced and trusted as a literal and readable Bible translation. The NASB offers clarity and readability while maintaining high accuracy to the original languages, which the NASB is known for. The NASB is available in many editions like a topical reference Bible. Researched and prepared by biblical scholars devoted to accuracy, the new topical reference Bible includes contemporary topics relevant to today's issues. From compact to giant print Bibles, find an NASB that fits your needs very affordably at nasbible.com. Trust, discover, and enjoy the NASB for yourself today. Go to nasbible.com. That's nasbible.com.
Tired of Bob Store Christianity, of doing church in a warehouse with all the trappings of a rock concert? Do you long for a more traditional and reverent style of worship? And how about the preaching? Perhaps you've begun to think that in-depth biblical exposition has vanished from Long Island. Well, there's good news. Wading River Baptist Church exists to provide believers with a meaningful and reverent worship experience, featuring the systematic exposition of God's Word. And this loving congregation looks forward to meeting you. Call them at 631-929-3512 for service times. 631-929-3512. Or check out their website at wrbc.us. That's wrbc.us.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnes, and if you just tuned in to Iron Sharpens Iron today, our guest for the first hour is Andrew Beckwith. And Andrew Beckwith has been our guest before here on Iron Sharpens Iron. We are discussing the frighteningly horrific and breathtakingly disturbing leftist totalitarian homosexual agenda that has gotten a lot of foothold, tragically, in this country. And Andrew is speaking as the president of Massachusetts Family Institute today. And immediately following his interview, we're going to be joined by a woman who Andrew has worked with. We're calling her Diane X in order to protect her family and especially her son, who has been identified by a school counselor as gay and who was removed from his Christian home by the Department of Children and Families, the DCF. But if you'd like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnsen@gmail.com, chrisarnsen@gmail.com. And I just want to, before I return to our discussion, I want to let you know that the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals and PNR Publishing, otherwise known as Presbyterian and Reform Publishing, want you to know about the Pastor's Retreat that is taking place May 9th through 11th, and that's going to be held at Harvey Cedars Bible Conference in Harvey Cedars, New Jersey, and Dan Doriani and David Powelson, both of whom have been guests on Iron Sharpens Iron, are going to be speaking on the theme, The Faithful Shepherd. And if you would like more information about attending this pastor's conference, the website is alliancenet.org. That's alliancenet.org. And then click on events at the very top of the page, and you'll be directed right to this Faithful Shepherd Conference, May 9th through 11th, 2016, at Harvey Cedars, New Jersey. We also want to let you know that the Iron Sharpens Iron Pastors Luncheon is being held April 28th at the Thornwald Mansion of Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and this is absolutely free of charge. David Wood of AnsweringMuslims.com is our keynote speaker, and we're going to have a special guest appearance by Pennsylvania State Representative Stephen Bloom, will have a few words of greeting for our pastors in attendance. This is for pastors and for men in ministry leadership. As I said, absolutely free of charge, free lunch, all taking place in the gorgeous and newly renovated Thornwald Mansion in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And each pastor is going to be leaving with a bag with about, I don't know, 50 to 100 pounds worth of books that have been donated by major Christian publishers all over the United States. So all of this, as I said, from beginning to end, is absolutely free of charge. And for more details, if you know a pastor that either or man in ministry leadership that lives in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, or who is willing to travel there on April 28th, that's a Thursday, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., have them email me at chrisarnzen@gmail.com, C-H-R-I-S-A-R-N-Z-E-N, @gmail.com. We do have an anonymous listener who wants to know, Andrew, was there a time in history before this insanity really took a foothold in the United States where there were doctors and parents being criminally prosecuted for this kind of activity or the attempts to do so with their children in regard to gender reassignment?
Not that I'm aware of. I think this is a the transgender ideology certainly is new. I mean, I continue to go back to Romans chapter 1, where Paul talks about, you know, you have a society that turns away from God and sort of exalts themselves, worships the creation as opposed to the Creator. What's the pinnacle of creation? Mankind. What is the sort of most enticing way to worship mankind? Is just through sex, as we've had temple prostitutes, you know, throughout history. And then once you get there, Paul talks about men exchanging relations with them for other men, burning with lust for each other, and then not only doing these things, but celebrating those who do them. So when you think of sort of the gay pride parades, you go back and read Romans 1, and it makes sense. Otherwise, it just seems like we're, you know, completely out of control, and we are, I think, morally getting there, but this is not anything that is outside the scope of God's Word. Sadly, this is, you know, predicted, this type of thing, and we've probably been through various cycles of this type of kind of mass delusion throughout history.
Well, I know that the earliest reference that I have ever heard of such a barbaric thing, such as the gender reassignment of a young person, comes from a book that a guest I had on recently, although I did not interview him on the subject of the Beast of Revelation, but that book, Dr. Kenneth Gentry, who identifies in his view of eschatology Nero as the Beast of Revelation, he says that he has pretty convincing historical documentation that Nero, when his wife died, found a young boy during one of his travels through a village that resembled his wife, and he actually had the young boy somehow, as much as they could do back then, physically altered to even more resemble a woman, and he married the young boy. But this is, of course, not somebody who is to be admired from history. Nero is one of the most satanic and grotesque and diabolical human beings that God ever allowed to be born of woman on this planet. We have Arnie in Perry County, Pennsylvania, who wants to know, do you see these insane laws protecting the homosexual agenda spreading rapidly outside of these liberal states you mentioned, Massachusetts and California? How much at risk is Pennsylvania, for instance, he asks?
Well, you've got a good man in Pennsylvania, Mike Gear, with the Pennsylvania Family Policy Council. So he's holding the line there. He's been doing that for a couple of decades, my counterpart in Pennsylvania. That being said, you know, just in the past couple of weeks, you have the Republican governor of Georgia refusing to sign a very sort of watered-down religious liberty bill because the LGBT agenda had a big outcry that this was sort of anti-gay legislation. This is stuff that wouldn't even have protected the proverbial bakers and florists and photographers who cannot in good conscience participate in a same-sex wedding. It would simply protect pastors from being forced to perform gay weddings. And yet you have a Republican governor in a conservative state refusing to sign even something that basic. If you look at the outcry nationally in North Carolina over them, to refusing to let a bathroom bill stand. So there is an intentional, and you can if you go to the HRC's website, the Human Rights Council is the major LGBT sort of clearinghouse for activists and lobbyists. They have a plan to target the red states.
Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, these laws are being pushed by not only Democrats, then the Republican Party is guilty of its own cowards in office who are bowing to the leftist agenda, then.
Yes, I mean, and that's, I think, again, been a deliberate strategy that's paying off very well right now for the homosexual movement, is to get big business on their side, because now they're able to use that as a wedge against sort of the traditional Republican consortium of free market big business folks and social conservatives. Well, big business is now getting on the side of social liberals on these issues, so it puts Republicans in a difficult position as elected officials, and they're caving on this stuff. So, and even if you have, as we had in over the past decade, I think it was 31 states that passed state constitutional amendments, mm-hmm. finding marriages with man and woman, most of them are sort of red states. You get five people in robes at the Supreme Court to overturn it, and all that's undone.
Now, barring a miracle, or barring the fulfillment of postmillennial eschatology and postmillennial hopes, do you see realistically, we all who are Christians believe God can do anything that he chooses to do. With God, all things are possible,
right,
as Jesus Christ himself said. But when you look at just the data, and when you look at what's going on in this, this country and in this culture, do you see realistically the ability of those with biblical morals to recapture lost ground? I mean, it almost seems like a dreamland that you're thinking of, to view the United States as being free from legal abortions and,
right,
and things that you're talking about. Does any of this look realistic as far as the data is concerned, what you're seeing in this country?
Sure. Well, I start by saying, as sort of the birthplace of, I think, two great awakenings, we would welcome a third here in Boston. So we always pray for that. But, short of something like that, I think we are entering a period where the sexual revolution has moved decisively from decriminalizing behavior that is immoral and sort of freeing up people to behave as they want despite the consequences, to now imposing onto other people's lives, like with the bathroom bill. So it's one thing, I think, for people to say, well, whatever you guys do in the privacy of your bedroom, fine, I don't care about that. But now that we're talking about putting Bruce Jenner in my daughter's locker room, there's going to be some more resistance. So the hope is that as people wake up to what is going on, they will bring a stop to the momentum, because it starts to impact their lives, directly. But that may or may not happen. I mean, the other side has so much momentum now and sort of controls the commanding heights of culture and the media and academia that sometimes my job is just to be the little boy in the fable of the Emperor's New Clothes, and be that person to shout, hey, he's not wearing anything, and it's okay to say that. So we try to have that sometimes prophetic role. Thinking long-term, if you look demographically, there was a report just out by, I think, the American Conservative Union that looked at all 50 states with a variety of metrics, one of which was demography. And it showed that the birth rate in Massachusetts is, I think, 1.58. Now, the replacement rate is 2.1 children per woman per lifetime. So what sort of gives me some hope long-term is that religious families, particularly conservative Christian families, tend to have more children, certainly more, average more than 1.58. Because they're living out family values. They're getting married, often get married younger, they stay married, they have children, while if the liberals live out their values, they're contracepting or aborting, so they're not having children, if they're even in couplings that are even potentially fertile. Obviously, same-sex couplings are not. So long-term, and there's been some demographic studies on this, long-term, conservative religious believers if they live out any values and pass those on to their children in a handful of generations, can really turn things around. So I would never be elected governor of Massachusetts because I'm just too conservative, but perhaps my great-grandson with the same values would be a viable candidate.
We have Christopher from Suffolk County, Long Island, New York, who asks, I don't know if you are at liberty to say, but is there a presidential candidate that you can publicly support as being most aligned with the goals of your organization?
Sure, good question. So we're a 501c3. We do issues, not candidates. That's kind of the short answer. That's kind of the answer I have as president of Massachusetts. If you go to the Family Research Council, I think FRC.org, they have primary voter guides for both the GOP and the Democratic Party, and it just sort of walks through a series of pro-family issues and where each candidate stands on those issues. And so part of my mission is to help people come to that conclusion themselves and just provide them with the information to do so. So FRC.org. Get to the voter guide.
And we, as you know, are going to be addressing the case of a woman that you are very familiar with. We are calling her Diane X.
Yep.
Before we actually interview Diane, if you could tell us as much about that case in a preparatory fashion for that interview, especially since some of our listeners may have to leave us at the 5 o'clock hour. If you could tell us something about that case with Diane X.
Sure. It's been a while since I've talked to her about this, so if I get any of the details wrong, I apologize. But as I recollect it, Diane's son was struggling with some same-sex attraction issues. They were getting him treatment, I think probably just counseling from a Christian counselor, if I remember correctly, to kind of explore where those feelings were coming from and how to handle them. They're a Christian family, trying to raise their son to love and serve the Lord, as we're all trying to. Again, if I remember correctly, they discovered that their son had been molested at the hands of an older boy in the neighborhood, and so they're trying to work through that and believe that some of his issues stemmed from that. He was going to public school, and I think at some point, the counselor that he was going to that he went to see, guidance counselor, adjustment counselor, they called him out to public school, recommended that he go to this community center in town that was run by a gay man, and the purpose of the community is to help LGBT youth. So he goes to this center, was referred out to this community center without his parents ever being informed, goes there, meets this guy, gets a bunch of books and materials that basically tell him that his parents are homophobic and bigoted religious people and that he's gay and should embrace that. At some point, the counselor from the school gets DCF involved because she's sort of embracing that same mentality that if Diane and her husband aren't supporting their son in his homosexual orientation, that there's an abuse issue, and so DCF gets involved, and the son is sort of taken to somebody else's house, I think by the school counselor. So essentially taken out of the home temporarily and estranged from the parents, all because the guidance counselor at school refers him out to this community center run by a homosexual man. So a wild array of violations of parental rights, and I'll bring it back to the bill that I spoke about initially on the counseling ban. The first part of that I talked about would make just that basic talk therapy that this boy was receiving would make that illegal and would classify it as child abuse. So that if you're a mandatory reporter, you had to report to the Department of Children and Families in Massachusetts if someone's getting counseling to deal with unwanted homosexual desires or gender identity issues. So we're really trying to stop that bill because that is a first sort of bold step in the direction of defining Christian beliefs as homophobia and then defining that homophobia as child abuse. And we can't pass our faith on to our children if they've been abducted by the Department of Children and Families and put in a home that is not Christian. And that's sort of the nightmare scenario. And tragically, Diane lived out some of that.
Yeah, this is really disturbing because it is obviously a blatant violation of the freedom of religion in this country. Mm-hmm. And what's to say that a government agency can't remove a child from their home who is being raised in an Orthodox Jewish family, and he just doesn't want to be an Orthodox Jew anymore, and he's a young child, or a Christian, or any other religion? I mean, this is just really bizarre that people are looking upon this as not only acceptable, but actually the right thing to do. And it's very obvious, it's painfully obvious that this has nothing to do with equal rights. Homosexuality trumps religion. No pun intended with Trump or anything.
Well, absolutely.
But
to people of faith. And it's very ironic here, obviously, in Massachusetts. I read a while back that one of the reasons why the Pilgrims left Holland, where they were sort of in exile for Britain, is that they saw their children sort of assimilating into the culture there, and they didn't want that to happen because it was contrary to their faith. They were being sort of led astray, so they went through all they went through to come here to the shores of Massachusetts so they could raise their children in freedom and in faith. And now both of those are in jeopardy.
Well, this is really twisted. It's just the way that all these things are escalating at a quicker pace. I mean, people forget that Barack Obama, when he was running for president, was against same-sex marriage, at least publicly.
Right.
And so were the Clintons before him. And now, for a person to say the very same things that the Clintons and Barack Obama used to say, that could involve that person losing their career, could Yep. involve them being fined heavily for something. I mean, it's just absolutely insane that the rapid pace which this totalitarian leftist homosexual agenda is really taking over. Now, people hear that kind of thing and they chuckle. They think this is conspiratorial kind of nuttiness, but this is actually what's happening. There's no debate about it. These things are happening.
Right. I mean, you've got the Republican governor of Georgia is refusing to sign religious liberty legislation that was signed by Bill Clinton at the federal level in the late 90s.
Yeah, I mean, this is just, I'm almost speechless, but if you could, I want to make sure that you say everything that you would like to have etched in the hearts and minds of our listeners today before you leave, and if we have time to take another question or two from the listeners after that, we will, but I just want to make sure we don't run out of time without you saying what you most want our listeners to remember when they leave this program today.
Well, and the most important thing is to get involved. I mean, the other side has been very organized and just relentless in lobbying people all across the spectrums of power and influence. So I encourage people to go to citizenlink.com. Citizenlink.com. It is the website for the national organization that works with groups like mine and Focus on the Family. And you can go there and you can find the group in your state. We're in 38 states right now. I'm trying to make it 50. And they will help you find out what's going on at the local level, the state level, where a phone call and an email and a visit at a state level for a state representative is going to have much more impact than the national level. Not saying that's not important, but you get sort of more bang for your buck in your time and effort. And so many of these things are occurring at the state level. So get involved, and citizenlink.com will give you the tools to do that.
Bibi from Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, wants to know, are you aware of churches and pastors losing any freedom of speech and religion in your state of Massachusetts and elsewhere, where they have actually been fined or prohibited from teaching the prohibitions of homosexuality that are clearly taught in the scriptures?
Sure, pastors per se are fairly well protected under existing U.S. law on the First Amendment. silver lining to that sort of Chinese wall of separation of church and state is that pastors are fairly well protected. That you have a gentleman who is a fire chief in Atlanta, Georgia, who was also an elder in his church, and he wrote a book, Men's Devotional, Homosexuality is a Sin. He was fired from his civilian job, but it was because of actions he took in a pastoral capacity. Here in Massachusetts, you have a Catholic all-girls school that refused to hire an openly homosexual man who was married to another man under Massachusetts law. They refused to hire him based on the fact they said, look, this is a Catholic school and we have certain behavioral conduct policies and standards because we're a faith-based school, so we can't hire you. And he sued and won just a few months ago, I think in December, won a case here in Massachusetts of discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. So now it's really up in the air how much religious freedom Christian schools have to make admissions and hiring decisions in line with their faith. And that's what the front lines are right now. It's sort of the parachurch organizations like church schools. But there's no question that churches will be coming next. In fact, there was just a case yesterday at the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, highest court in the state, dealing with whether a large tract of land that was owned by a church, if part of that could be taxed because it wasn't used for worship purposes, which gets kind of deep in the weeds. But if they have the power to say, okay, half of your property isn't used for religious purposes, so we can tax it, they can also tell you have to hire a transgender organist, for example.
Now, is this all theory that you're speaking of? I mean, do across the board in every state in this country, can Christian schools only offer when they're looking for teachers and they're hiring individuals, can they exclusively hire those who share their religious beliefs?
So it depends on the state. The federal constitutional law on this issue is there's a ministerial exemption, so people can hire the ministers. But how far that does that extend to the worship leader, to the Sunday school teacher, to the sexton or the janitor? Some of that's open for debate. And the case in Massachusetts was based on some poorly written state statutes. But if people have questions about that, I would go to AllianceDefendingFreedom.org. You're familiar with ADF as well. AllianceDefendingFreedom.org. They have some wonderful resources for pastors and churches and Christian schools on how to protect their ministry from sexual orientation and gender identity lawsuits.
Now, is it just the homosexual agenda that has gotten a stronghold in this area that you're talking about? Well, for instance, can somebody who is a Muslim sue a Christian church for not hiring him as a librarian or whatever the case may
right.
be?
I mean, they taught me in law school, to answer the question, can you sue, the answer is always yes, but whether you win or not is another question. So realistically, no, because you can make faith-based decisions, again, broadly speaking, in your hiring, but where churches and schools get in trouble, like the one in Massachusetts, is that this homosexual man who's married to the man claimed he was Catholic. And said, when the school said it was Catholic, it means you do prayers every day, which I have no problem with. So he claimed, the only reason they're hiring me is because of my sexual orientation. The courts have, in some places, including Massachusetts, refused to differentiate between orientation and behavior. So you could have a school that say, look, whatever sexual desires you have, we're not going to ask you about those desires. We're concerned about what you do with those desires. Just like all our married heterosexual men and women that need to remain faithful to their spouses or celibate until they're married. Same thing for someone if you have same-sex desires. You can either marry someone of the opposite sex, like everybody else, or remain celibate. But the courts have unfortunately bought into this idea that someone's orientation is who they are. It's an immutable characteristic like race, and actions they take in, consistent with it. So getting married to another man, that's part of their fundamental identity, and can't discriminate against it.
Well, I know that your website is mafamily.org, MA for Massachusetts, family.org.
Right.
And I really appreciate you being on the program, and I eagerly look forward to you returning to the broadcast, Mr. Beckwith. And God bless you, and thank you for being a wealth of information today.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
And I want everybody to stay tuned, because coming up we have Diane X. She is the woman that we mentioned a couple of times, who is a Christian and who had a son who was identified as a school counselor as gay and then later removed from his Christian home by the Department of Children and Families, otherwise known as DCF. We're going to be hearing her story after these messages, so don't go away. We're going to be right back.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750, that's 508-528-5750, or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at ProvidenceBaptistChurchMA.org, that's ProvidenceBaptistChurchMA.org, or even on SermonAudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Thrivent Financial is not your typical financial services provider. As a membership organization, we help Christians be wise with money and live generously every day. And for the fourth year in a row, we were named one of the world's most ethical companies by the Ethisphere Institute, a leading international think tank dedicated to the creation, advancement, and sharing of best practices in business ethics. Contact me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433 to learn more about the Thrivent Difference.
Finances and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Welcome back. This is Chris Orange, and if you just tuned us in, our second hour, we're going to be featuring as our guest someone who is going to remain anonymous, and we are calling her Diane X. Diane X is the mother of a boy who was identified by his school counselor as being gay and who was later removed from his Christian home by the Department of Children and Families, otherwise known as DCF. And we're going to hear more about this tragic story from our guest herself. And it's my honor and privilege to welcome you for the very first time to Iron Sharpens Iron, Diane X.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you? And I'd like to introduce...
Hi.
I'm sorry?
I said I'm fine.
Oh, okay. I'd like to introduce you to my co-host, Reverend Buzz Taylor.
Good to meet you.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, let's go back as far as we can go in regard to just the day that the Lord blessed you, your husband, and your family with this precious baby that he brought into this world through you. And tell us about his upbringing and so on.
He was a really smart kid. He was involved in a lot of things with growing up, like a lot of kids are. He played the piano. He was a competitive swimmer. He was active in the youth group. He played piano with a praise band. He was sort of a typical kid, but he was also very he was very bright. We didn't actually realize how bright until he was starting to struggle in school. The school wanted him on medication. We took him to a psychologist who said that he was testing several years above grade level, and that he wasn't performing because he was bored. And also he was being bullied in school. We went in and complained on a regular basis, and the school didn't do a very good job protecting him. He was socially immature. He was small for his age, so he was seen as weak, I guess, by some of his peers, and they started early on calling him, they were calling him loser and freak and faggot and gay in school, and those kinds of things helped to shape his, homosexual identity. And we eventually moved him to a private Christian school, and that's when he kind of told us more about some of the, bullying and other stuff that had happened. And at that point, I know Andrew said that we were sending him to a Christian counselor. We had actually taken him to a counselor that we were referred to by our pediatrician. She wasn't a Christian counselor. We were trying to address actually the first counselor we sent him to called it post-traumatic stress, what he had experienced, and it was heartbreaking. I mean, no parent wants to see their child or know that their child has has been bullied and has emotional issues as a result of it. So he was seeing this counselor, and eventually when he started going to this club outside of school, they convinced him to quit counseling because now they were counseling him. And I asked early on in his, probably a few months after he started going to counseling, I asked the counselor, is he going to think he's gay now? And she said, oh, no. She said, he doesn't act, gay. She said, what was he interested in when he was growing up? What kinds of things did he play? And I said, well, he played, superheroes. He liked big trucks. He has always been interested in computers. And she said, oh, no, he's not gay. But see, even in the field of psychology, these psychologists going through school now, they're trained that you're born gay or not, which isn't true. The actual research shows that that the causes of homosexuality or sexual identity issues is it can be abusive parenting, it can be being the victim of excessive bullying or being rejected by same-gendered peers in school during the formative years, which is happened to my son. It can be childhood sexual abuse or experimentation, exposure to pornography, and other environmental factors. And the interesting thing is, if you look deeply into the people who are writing this homosexual agenda, they admit this. But they also say that basically we have to deceive the public about this, because if they knew that that was the case, then they wouldn't like fall in line with this agenda. So they have to keep alive the whole myth that, well, people are born that way, so we need to, you know, value them, you know, and encourage them in who they are, when in fact, decades, you know, worth of research shows that that's not the case.
And how young was your son when he was starting to get counseled by these more liberal psychological sources?
Well, I mean, now it's starting in kindergarten, but and we weren't aware of it until our son was in high school. He went to a Christian school for a little while, and then we ended up sending him and his sister to a public high school because we couldn't afford to keep them at the Christian school and then pay for college and all that. So they went to the local technical school, and we really felt that our son needed that because he was going into the field of technology, and we felt that they could give him more of an education in that. But it was at the age of 16 when our son told the adjustment counselor at his high school that he thought he might be gay. And of course, there's activist counselors, guidance counselors, and teachers in the school that are promoting this stuff and telling kids about it. And, you know, basically, suggesting to these impressionable kids that, you know, if you feel not accepted or you feel different or, whatever, you may be gay or you may be bisexual or transgendered or whatever. There's now over 50 identity or more sexual identities. It's ridiculous. You send your kid to school hoping that they're learning math and English and history, but what they're learning are all the sexual identities that they could possibly be, and how to engage in this lifestyle and how to deal with people who disagree. And so it was at age 16 he went to this guidance counselor who we later learned was the LGBT advocate in the school, and she referred our son to, it's called the Cape and Islands Gay Straight Youth Alliance, 6CS for short, without our knowledge or consent. And she didn't know at that time that he was receiving counseling, you know, from this therapist that the pediatrician had referred us to. But at 6CS, he was told that he was born gay, that he could never change, that anyone who didn't embrace his sexual identity was a hater and a homophobe, you know, including his family and the people in our church. You know, his whole life was closely tied to our family and our church. And people, you know, those encouraging him to abandon his family and faith, which is basically what they were doing, they caused a sense of confusion, pain, and stress on an already, you know, emotionally fragile kid. And it wasn't just a critical time in his social and emotional development, because, you know, we all know that teenagers are not, you know, adults, and they need, you know, guidance, and they're trying to figure out who they are. But it was also a time when he was learning how to drive. He was preparing to graduate from high school. He was selecting a college. And so trying to help him through these coming-of-age responsibilities was exceptionally challenging, as people were undermining our authority as his parents and, you know, questioning our ability to raise him. So at Sixia, where the school sent him to, he was provided with sexually provocative materials and anti-Christian literature. And when I asked the adjustment counselor, who was the LGBT liaison, you know, what gave her the right to refer our 16-year-old son to an organization outside of school without our knowledge or consent, she said that she didn't refer him, but she merely gave him a business card. When we talked to school administrators, they defended her action, and we asked, you know, what law allows you to do this? and they said that there were some current, cases that had, through judicial activism, had established some precedent. But, you know, I did some of my own research and found that there are numerous Supreme Court cases spanning decades that declare it unconstitutional to interfere with the fundamental rights of parents to direct the education and upbringing of their children.
Now, to your knowledge, were these same-sex attractions that your son was experiencing, were they prior to this counseling, or was the counseling itself influencing him and cultivating this in your son?
Well, you know, I think a lot of kids, especially, like I said, if you grow up, you know, and your peers are calling you faggot,
right,
gay and queer, or if you've been exposed to pornography, and, you know, one of the things that I think people are doing is they're trying to expose kids to these things that will spark curiosities in them. And then they start wondering, or experimentation. I mean, you may have a friend whose uncle is sexually abusing him, and he starts experimenting on your kid, or, you know, things like that can happen that cause kids to be confused. And so, you know, in school, some of these kids growing up, they wonder. And the thing is, most kids who have confusion growing up, who think, you know, am I or aren't I, they overcome it on their own without any kind of intervention. I read one study that said as many as 20 to 25% of kids growing up have questions or like wonder. Even like teenage monkeys experiment with this kind of stuff. But in adulthood, it's less than 2% of the population actually identifies as LGBT, and this has been a consistent number by the Center of Disease Control. Now, you wouldn't know that based on watching television, and this is actually another one of the lies that the agenda pushes out there, is that 10% of the population is gay or lesbian or LGBT, and that that's a myth that's been propagated for, you know, several decades now, when in fact it's only less than 2%.
Now, was our first guest, Andrew Beckwith, was he getting the story right, or was he confusing your son's case with another case when he said that there was some kind of a molestation that occurred from an older boy?
Well, I don't go into details about what happened
to
my kid. It really doesn't matter. I mean, kids come to these conclusions based on a lot of things. But the issue is that there are people in the school that are selling this stuff to kids. You know,
right.
One of their goals, if you want to know the framework for the agenda, there's a book called After the Ball, and it was written in the 1980s by Marshall Kirk and Hunter Madsen, and they both basically outlined this agenda. Now, one of them is was really successful, highly successful in the marketing industry, and the other one was a professional in the field of neuropsychology, and basically they set out with this marketing campaign and this psychological reconditioning strategy. And over the past few decades, they've used these strategies they've used like the television, they've used the schools, they've used legal legislature to push this agenda forward, so we had no idea how pervasive it was in the schools until we started until our son was referred to this organization. And then we, you know, started doing some research. And one of the goals has been to get a Gay Straight Alliance Club in every school across the United States, every high school. And they're almost there. I mean, they're pretty close to accomplishing that. And the way they do this is they have is through activist teachers and counselors who are in the school. So this particular counselor, there was no Gay Straight Alliance Club in this technical school. She refers kids like my son to this outside organization, and then there he gets trained on how to bring a club into his school. He learns, you know, what to teach in this club. He learns how to get administrators to accept this club, and they even offer, you know, legal backup. There's legal organizations that, and so these kids, they go and they threaten administrators with lawsuits if they don't let a club in the school. And then once the club is in the school, then they draw all these kids in, and then they teach all the stuff they want to teach. And the other thing that they do is they also take these kids to the state house and they train them how to be legal activists. So they're basically recruiting an army right out of the public schools. Now, they're almost done, like I said, in getting these clubs in every high school across America. Now they're moving into middle schools, and they're eventually going to move into elementary schools. Legally, I think you can only, a club gets introduced in the school by a student, but, you know, I talked to a assistant principal in Chelsea the other day, and she introduced me to a math teacher who said, she said, he started the Gay Straight Alliance Club in the middle school. Well, that's not allowed. You know, the activist teachers aren't allowed to start clubs. Only students are allowed to start clubs. But this is how they're grabbing hold of our kids. But the other thing, too, to mention is, you know, the whole homosexual marriage, one of the main purposes of that wasn't just so people could get, you know, married. It was to have access to the schools, because once you legalize homosexual marriage, then the schools can teach it as, you know, another kind of normal. That was one of the main purposes of homosexual marriage.
Yeah, that seems like a very logical part of that agenda.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting that liberalism at one time, pretty much straight across the board, used to universally condemn people who stereotyped other individuals. But now it seems that the liberals themselves, especially the pro-homosexual advocates, are very much in favor of stereotyping a child because they want to claim that child as one of their own, being homosexual. There was a time when a liberal would say, how dare you say a young man is gay just because he likes ballet or likes other things like dress design or whatever the case is. Or a young girl is a lesbian. How dare you call her a lesbian because she plays with trucks or likes carpentry or sports? Now there, it seems like you're insinuating here that these counselors are saying, yeah, that kid's gay because of these stereotypical traits that they would want to identify somebody as a homosexual with.
Well, here's what they're doing. I mean, it's not okay to just call a girl playing with trucks a lesbian because she may be queer, or she may be gender queer, or she may be gender non-conforming, or and this is what they learn. Every child gets to pick their own sexual identity. They're taught that, you know, there are as many sexual identities as there are people in the world. So if you call a girl who likes other girls a lesbian, and she's queer, she may be offended by that. You know, why do you think I'm lesbian? I'm genderqueer. So these teachers in school, they have to be really careful about offending kids in, you know, every which way. I mean, these poor teachers who are really there and dedicated to educating our kids, it's a really difficult environment for them to be in right now because, you know, basically you have these people going into the schools and teaching these kids how to be rebellious. I mean, one of the activities there's a group called the GLESN, Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, and this is one of this organization was created in I think it was 1995 to push homosexuality throughout the schools, starting in kindergarten. And one of their annual activities is the Day of Silence, where this year it's on April 15th, where kids who are LGBT or their allies or their teachers who are supporting them, because there are, you know, activist teachers within the school and counselors who are, you know, also in there to push this agenda, they don't talk all day long in support of how supposedly LGBT people feel being in the school all the time. And basically, it's not only a day of propaganda for the whole LGBT community, sponsored by GLESN, but it's also a day of intimidation for any students with, you know, opposing views. Some of the pro-family organizations out there are saying that if your school has a day of silence, and you can't even, like, I asked the administrators at my kid's high school, are you having a day of silence? And they're like, well, we don't sponsor anything like that. But in fact, they did have it. They just weren't sponsoring it, but they weren't punishing any parents or any students or teachers who were involved in it, either handing out materials or not talking or whatever. So these pro-family organizations are sponsoring a day of silence walkout in protest against schools allowing this to happen.
We're going to be going to a break right now, and when we come back, I'd like to hear more about your specific case when the Department of Children and Families got involved in almost Gestapo-like fashion, it seems. But if you'd like to join us on the air, anybody listening with a question of your own, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. Don't go away. We're going to be right back with Diane X and more of her story right after these messages.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750. That's 508-528-5750. Or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at providencebaptistchurchma.org. That's providencebaptistchurchma.org. Or even on sermonaudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Attention coin collectors and investors. Long Island Galleries of Wading River, New York has brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars for only $54 per coin, with free shipping and handling for a limited time. There's a 40-coin limit, So order now while supplies last. Call 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express welcome. Prices subject to change, so call now at 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. If you prefer ordering your brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan Silver dollars by check, mail it today to Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. That's Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. Remember, they're only $54 per coin with free shipping and handling and a 40-coin limit. New York State residents must add sales tax. Long Island Galleries is honored to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. See the Long Island Galleries display ad at ironsharpensironradio.com.
Lynbrook Baptist Church on 225 Earl Avenue in Lynbrook, Long Island, is teaching God's timeless truths in the 21st century.
Our church is far more than a Sunday worship service.
It's a place of learning where the scriptures are studied and the preaching of the gospel is clear and relevant.
It's like a gym where one can exercise their faith through community involvement.
It's like a hospital for wounded souls where one can find compassionate people and healing.
We're a diverse family of all ages,
enthusiastically serving our Lord Jesus Christ.
In fellowship, play, and together.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bob Waldeman, and I invite you to come and join us here at Lynbrook Baptist Church and see all that a church can be.
Call Lynbrook Baptist at 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402. Or visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnes, and if you just tuned in to Iron Sharpens Iron for the last half hour, we have had Diane X as our second guest today here on Iron Sharpens Iron. She is the mother of a boy identified by a school counselor as gay, who was later removed from his Christian home by the Department of Children and Families, otherwise known as DCF. And we've been hearing about this horrific story from Diane X. And if you could, Diane, let our listeners know exactly how the Department of Children and Families stepped into this situation in your home.
Okay, so by the time my husband, my son was in high school, earlier on he was socially mature, he was small for his age, all that. By high school, he was of average height. He was farming with his intellectual peers, being in the technical program at the high school. He was an advanced learner. And then when he basically came out, and I hate that expression, but when he came out in 11th grade, he almost flunked out that year. He almost flunked 11th grade. And he was also in and out of the hospital threatening to commit suicide. Now, LGBT activists will say it's because his parents are haters and homophobes, but, you know, we believe it's because, you know, these people who had entered his life were telling him that, you know, the people who loved him the most and the faith that he grew up in, you know, it was all a lie. We were all haters and homophobes. And, you know, what could be more awful, you know, for a kid to hear than that? So his long-term therapist and his educational advocate, and then another therapist that we brought in around that time, while working with us to help our son, they wanted a comprehensive psychological evaluation to determine how suicidal he really was and to address, you know, the irrational thoughts and behaviors that he was exhibiting around that time. And because we were financially, we were struggling at that time because private school hadn't been in our plan, and at that time there were a lot of medical bills pouring in. So they suggested having the school hire an evaluator, since our son's issues were affecting his ability to perform in school. And the head counselor agreed to it, and she arranged it. She knew our educational advocate. She knew the long-term counselor that the pediatrician had referred us to, because they were involved in, my son being a gifted learner and being on a 504 plan. They had attended, you know, his meetings, and then I gave her the business card of the other therapist, A short time after that, we received the psychologist's report. And now, normally, when an evaluation like that is done, it involves input from the parents and from the professionals requesting the evaluation. But the school psychologist did this evaluation without any input from any of us, only from our son and from the school. Who had, they had already exposed their biases. And in this report, he accused us of socially isolating and emotionally abandoning our son, among other things. When I showed this report to the two counselors, the two therapists we had involved in the educational advocate, they were horrified. And one of the therapists knew this psychologist who had done the evaluation and said to me, his worldview is all over that report. We tried to have it removed, this report removed from our son's permanent school record, which was our legal right to do because it was slanderous and untrue, and we were able to prove that that was the case. The school would not remove it, and so we instructed them in writing to concern themselves only with educational and college planning matters and to refer all of our son's, personal or emotional issues to his long-term therapist. The one that the pediatrician had referred us to. Well, on one Friday morning, after a family argument, a guidance counselor illegally drove to our neighborhood. They picked up our son and they drove him to school. And we later learned that his emotional state on that morning was brought on as a result of a romantic breakup. So the boy he had essentially come out for ended the relationship. And all of our team of professionals involved had warned us that when this happened, when this relationship broke up, it was going to be very devastating for him, and they feared what he might do. So, he just disappeared from the house, and, later on I was dropping my daughter off at school and went to the guidance office to tell them that our son wouldn't be in, and I intended to go and look for him, but I found him there in the counseling office. And I spent the whole entire, rest of the school day in the office, essentially being interrogated by the guidance counselors. And my husband was on and off the phone. He was trying to handle his crisis at work and trying to talk to the counselors, and especially the one who was the LGBT liaison. And she told us at the end of the day that we needed to allow him to go cool off at a friend's house over the weekend and agreed to family counseling through the Department of Children and Families, DCF, or they were going to put him in the system. So I had a long argument with her. I had concerns about the people that they wanted him to stay with over the weekend. But after being, she threatened me and she pressured me, and I finally agreed to her terms only to prevent DCF from taking custody of our son. So that was Friday afternoon. On the following Monday morning, a DCF supervisor came to our house. She called us unaccepting parents in front of our son, told us he wasn't staying there despite our objections, and returned him to the home where he had been staying over the weekend. She did it despite our concerns about the parents, who basically failed to provide boundaries or rules or discipline for their own children. And this house, it hadn't been vetted or anything. She said he's not staying here and told him to pack his things, and she took him out and delivered him to these, to this family. A couple weeks later, the social worker assigned to our case, at my insistence, she contacted the team of professionals working with our son, they said to send him home. There was no reason why he should be in DCF custody. She did her job. She did an investigation and all that. When she came to our home to return him and to close our case, she said that she told him that not only did we not abuse and neglect him, which are the only legal reasons a child can be removed from his parents, but she found that we loved him very much. And she told him that's not something I get to see a lot of in my job. But when we later, a couple months later, we received a letter from DCF indicating that they were closing our case because we no longer needed their services. So I called her up, and I demanded a letter stating that we were innocent, and that's when she told me we were never accused of anything, that it was her understanding that he was removed from our home at our request and brought to family friends with our permission. And subsequently we tried to, we obtained our records and filed a complaint against the DCF supervisor. They tried to withhold our records. We actually had to get a lawyer involved in getting the at first they released the partial records, but they purposely left out the part I was looking for, which proved that we did not voluntarily get interference by DCF, but that that we were only agreeing to family counseling, not to have our son taken away. We were denied after filing a complaint. They basically failed to follow their own policies and procedures. They refused to conduct a thorough investigation. They denied us a hearing. And they didn't do anything that they were supposed to when a complaint is filed.
We have a listener in Mechanicsburg, Harrison, who wants to know, at the initial stage when your child was being removed from your home, did you call the police or any other authority to even make sure that what was being done was legal?
Well, no. I mean, basically, she came to our house that Monday morning, that Monday afternoon, we didn't know what our rights were, and she made me sign a voluntary request for services, and she said, what she said to me was, you agreed to family counseling through DCS, so you need to sign this. At first when we talked to her, she gave me a form and she said, you need to sign this. I said, what is it? And she said, it's for him to get DCS services. I said, I'm not signing this. I said, we're not asking for this. She tried to hand it to my husband and he said, I'm not doing it. She actually gave it to my son and said, You're old enough now. You can sign it yourself. She said, you're 17. You can sign yourself in. And my husband said to her, you need to tell him what he is signing and what this means to him. You know, what you will do to him. And when she explained, he refused to sign it. But he asked to return to this other family. She said she was going to take him, and at first she tried to get another place. She called her office and tried to find another place for a, you know, angry 17-year-old teenager at the end of the day, and she was not able to find something. So he said, well, I have somewhere I can go, and so she took him there. But she gave me this form, this voluntary request for services form, and she said, you agreed to family counseling. You need to sign this. And so I'm trying to read it, and she's pressuring me. And at that point, she was already telling me she was taking my son, and I was afraid of not cooperating because she was taking my son, and I was afraid what my lack of cooperation would, you know, do. So it asked, one of the questions asked what services you were looking for, and so I wrote in counseling. And so later on when I was talking to the social worker assigned to the case, she said, well, you signed voluntary. And I said, I agreed to counseling. That was the only thing I agreed to. And I signed it under duress after she told me she was already taking my son. But what people need to understand is that the LGBT activists are in all of these organizations. Every office of the Massachusetts Department of Children and Families across the state has an LGBT liaison. I went up to one of the youth pride parades up in Boston. Kids who are in these gay, straight, and alliance clubs, they get in buses and they take them into Boston once a year for these youth pride parades. And all of these, like, you know, angry, hurting, you know, rebellious kids are just marching down the street, you know, half, you know, dressed with things written all over their bodies, and they're waving their fists and telling everybody watching, don't assume your kids are straight. And, I mean, these are kids who are, like I said, they've grown up with traumatic situations in their lives, and they're being used by these activists. So at one of the parades, my husband and I went, and DCF was marching in the parade. They had their big banner. They had, after the parade, they had a booth set up. And what they are doing is they are convincing these kids that if your family doesn't, you know, embrace your homosexuality, then they are abusive. And I went up to their table afterwards, and I said, oh, so what do you do to help the LGBT community? And they told me, well, we actively seek, LGBT foster parents and adoptive parents. And of course, we know from Andrew's time on your show before, Andrew Beckwith's time on your show before, that that they're screening out Christian parents.
Yeah.
But they're actively seeking LGBT parents for these kids. And DCF is under investigation. The Massachusetts legislature has collected a number of stories like mine of abuses against families. And they, when kids who are in DCF custody are found dead or missing or whatever, DCF keeps saying, well, we don't have enough resources, we don't have enough money, and then the state just gives them more money, and what do they use this money for? Well, they use it to go, vet Christian families and say, sorry, you can't do this. So all these potential, foster parents who could be very good for these children are screened out. They're using money to actively seek LGBT, parents. They're, I don't know if these women were getting paid for marching in these parades, but they're out teaching these kids that their parents are being abusive. I think telling kids who have had traumatic histories that their parents hate them. And the other thing that's not being told is, a lot of people ask me, why can't you just accept that your son is gay? Why can't you just embrace his homosexuality? And I tell them, because if you Google the consequences of homosexual behavior, unstable and multiple relationships throughout their lives, a 25 to 30 year decrease in life expectancy,
mm-hmm.
chronic and potential fetal liver disease, infectious hepatitis, risk of liver cancer, HIV, AIDS, and other immune diseases and associated cancers, fatal rectal cancer, multiple bowel and other infectious diseases, depression, anxiety, thoughts of suicide, higher than average rates of alcoholism, drug addiction, and other mental health issues. I say, which one of those do you want your child to suffer from?
Right.
And the thing is, there's a lot of proof too that that people can change their sexual identity. People who have there's a whole big ex-gay population out there. People who had traumas in their childhood, who got the proper therapies that they needed to overcome those, and now live healthy heterosexual lifestyles. And of course, Andrew addressed in the first hour that the LGBT community is trying to stop these therapies.
Right.
They don't want these kids to be healed from the traumas of their childhood. They want to keep them angry activists for the rest of their lives.
Now, are you aware of any exaggerations that your son may have told these agencies and so on, or his counselors, just because he was in a stage of youthful rebellion and wanted to act out these newly found attractions and so on? Was he exaggerating any kind of abuse that he was claiming was going on in the home?
No, actually, no. And that's the thing, is he it's interesting, several months before this happened, when he wanted to he wanted permission to do things that we couldn't allow him to do because it was risky behavior. He told me, he said, you know, not allowing me to do what I want is abusive, and you know, DCF could take me away, and they'll take my sister too. So, and I said to my husband afterwards, I'm like, somebody is coaching him. Somebody
right.
is filling his head with all this stuff. But no, the social worker said that we did not abuse or neglect him. There was never any evidence of that. He never accused us of any of that. This was all their feelings that we had. And I asked the woman, the DCS woman at the parade, I said, what if hypothetically there was like a religious family and their kid, was gay or lesbian, what would you do in a case like that? And they said, oh, yeah, we would remove them from the home. And I said, what if there's no, evidence of abuse or neglect? And they said, well, not accepting their homosexuality is emotional abuse. So there doesn't have to be any real abuse or neglect, any evidence of that. Just not accepting your child's homosexuality is seen as abuse.
Well, you mentioned he has a sister. And that obviously there was a threat that, you know, we're going to go after her too. Was there any problem with that?
With her being taken away, you mean?
Or threatened or whatever. Was there any threats to take her away also?
No, they didn't, they didn't take her, no.
Okay.
But I can tell you that she was deeply affected by everything.
Oh, I imagine. Yes.
In our family, yeah. And, it took her a while to heal from that, and I think she probably still is.
What is the present situation now? Where does this all stand?
Well, our son went off to college in another state. He joined right in with, they hooked him right up to the people down there to promote homosexual marriage in that state. He almost flunked out of college. My husband threatened to yank the money, and then he went back and pulled it all together, and he actually got the Advanced Achievement Award and had to, he did excellent, finished out his college with excellent grades. He has a good career, but he still has, he says that the stuff that happened to him when he was younger doesn't affect him anymore, but he'll also say that he has social anxiety issues. He has a boyfriend, and he's a nice young man who we like very much, but we don't like the relationship. And we would like both of the boys to heal from the things in their childhood that have led them, have caused their confusion. But it's basically the people behind this agenda that led them down this road.
Mm-hmm. Now, they say that hindsight is 20/20 vision. What, if any, things would you do differently if this scenario were to replay in the current day? And what kind of advice would you give parents listening about how to prevent something similar from happening, if there is anything that you believe you could have done?
Well, I think people need to educate themselves on how pervasive this really is. There are two really good websites. One is Mass Resistance. If you Google Mass Resistance, a guy, Brian Kamiker, he's done a lot of research. He sends people into the schools and into these parades, and I don't think anybody, except maybe Linda Harvey, another one, Mission America. If you Google Mass Resistance or Mission America, you can see how pervasive, this stuff is in the schools. And you can also Google GLESEN, the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, GLSEN. And you can see right from their own materials what they are teaching from your children, kindergarten and up. You know, I can't say that any child growing up in the public schools these days is safe. I mean, there's the schools, there are activists in all the schools, and they're there to expose your children to this stuff. I think that people need to do whatever they can to limit it, but you need to know if you're the parent of a child in school, you need to know what's going on in your child's school. You need to visit the classroom. You need to look at the bookshelves. You need to review what they bring home in their backpack. Talk to them. You need to understand that since God was removed from the tools, what the kids are learning in school is an atheist, secularist worldview. Whether you're talking about evolution or global warming or revisionist history, the children, you need to basically, if you're going to keep your kids in public schools, supplement their education, give them the other side of the story, teach them creationism and teach them another version of history where the founding fathers are actually nice people. Teach them your worldview. You need to shut off the TV and have kids, I love Ben Carson's story. His mom made him read all the time. So instead of, watching TV and running around with the gang, he was educating himself. Shut off the TV. Understand that LGBT activists took over Hollywood a long time ago, and propaganda is in just about every TV show. There's also graphic surveys, and you can read about this on Mass Resistance. There's actually a sample of what, when surveys are done in school, and these are surveys done by the CDC, Center of Disease Control, but they are actually, Gleason is behind them, and they put all kinds of ideas in children's heads. Don't opt your kids out of these. Any time a permission slip comes home, can your child read this book? Can your child do this global warming, project? One of the things that I think parents really need to do is fight Common Core, because, once Common Core gets implemented fully, there'll be no stopping any of this stuff. But parents need to know that you can... If parents get together, and I think church leaders need to start fighting this stuff, when there is pushback from parents, it works. And when there is, when there are groups of people fighting, Andrew Beckwith was saying how, the anti-therapy bill has already passed in a couple of states. The bathroom bill stuff is already occurring in other states. Massachusetts is ground zero for all of this stuff, and yet we've been able to put a hold on those couple of bills because organizations like Mass Family Institute and Mass Resistance within our own state are fighting this stuff and getting people to go out to the state house and fight this stuff. And we need to see bigger, groups, bigger pushback from the faith-based community. But understand that the Department of Education is intertwined with the LGBT community, the NEA, the National Education Association, the National Association of School Superintendents, the elementary and secondary school principals, school committees. In our own towns, we hire school committee members or vote in what school committee members who will watch out for what our kids are learning. Well, they go to school committee boot camp where they're told what their responsibilities are going to be, and they basically have the influence in these conferences, like shutting down what these school committee people should be doing, misleading them about what their responsibilities are supposed to be.
Well, I want to give the websites of a couple of these organizations that we've been mentioning. First of all, Mass Resistance, their website is massresistance.org. I had the privilege of interviewing Sean Ryan from Mass Resistance not long ago. That's massresistance.org. and the Massachusetts Family Institute, whose president we interviewed for the first hour, Andrew Beckwith. Their website is MA for MassachusettsFamily.org, MAFamily.org. Diane, it's been a pleasure interviewing you, and I'm going to be praying for you and your son and your family. I'm sure many of our listeners will as well. And I just want our listeners to know, and I want them to always remember for the rest of their lives, that Jesus Christ is a far greater Savior than you are a sinner. We look forward to hearing from you and your questions the next time on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. God bless.